This is Senior Editor Mark Bauerlein with the first conversation in a series entitled Religion and Culture. In each episode, which will appear about once per month, I'll welcome one guest for a conversation on a topic in politics, education, literature, law, or, of course, religion. We presume that First Things audiences hear in the term culture the wellsprings of religious faith, which we believe forms the basis of any healthy society. In our day, it seems, the status of religion and the culture that follows from it has in good part been turned over to the courts. Judges tell us where religion properly ends in public affairs, and some private ones too. Some of them have shown themselves frankly hostile to religious conviction, such as Richard Posner of the Court of Appeals in Chicago. Their opinions have weighed heavily on free exercise and religious conscience. But the most recent decisions by the Supreme Court have given religious believers some cause for optimism. I'm not going to explain that, though. My guest is. Mark Movsesian is the Frederick A. Whitney Professor of Contract Law and the Director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's University in New York. Mark, you've been here before, and First Things readers know you well from your writings on our website. So let's skip the introductions and get straight to the issue. What happened to religious liberty last month in the court?
Well, actually, Mark, there was a flurry of activity at the end of the court's term. Last month, there were three big decisions in the law and religion area. One of them was a merits decision in a case called Trinity Lutheran, which is the so-called Blaine Amendment case out of Missouri. And then the court also granted cert in two other cases. One of them is Masterpiece Cake Shop, which is a case out of Colorado in which a baker declined to design and bake a cake for a same-sex wedding. And the other is the travel ban case involving President Trump's executive order excluding immigrants from certain Muslim-majority countries for 90 days. The court is going to hear both of those cases at its next term, which begins in October.
Good. Well, we'll get to the Colorado Baker case, especially the details of that may be of interest to our readers, because sometimes the details are a little lost in the general public presentation of that case in the media. But in terms of the Missouri case, give us the background on that case.
Okay, so this is a case out of Missouri in which the state of Missouri refused to allow a church to participate in a public grant program for resurfacing playgrounds. This was a state program that gave financial assistance to nonprofit organizations that were going to be resurfacing their playgrounds. It was using recycled tires. But because of a state constitutional provision, the church was not allowed to participate in this program. Now, what was that provision? There's a provision in the Missouri State Constitution that forbids direct or indirect state financial aid to churches or to church-affiliated, church-controlled organizations. We refer to this by the shorthand, the Blaine Amendment. Actually, some of my colleagues tell me that it's not quite a Blaine Amendment. The Blaine Amendment is a 19th century device named after Senator Blaine from the state of Maine, who ran for president, actually, on the Republican ticket against Grover Cleveland.
Was this James G. Blaine?
James G. Blaine. Continental lawyer from the state of Maine, who ran against Grover Cleveland and lost, actually. That's a whole different New York story. James G. Blaine had a surrogate who here in New York famously said the Democrats were the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion. Uh-huh. And many people think that tipped the election in favor of Grover Cleveland. But the Blaine Amendments said that there could be no state assistance to religious educational institutions. So this wasn't quite that, but still it's in the same ballpark. This was a constitutional provision that said no direct or indirect state financial aid for churches. And so therefore, Missouri said to the Trinity Lutheran Church, well, we're sorry, you can't participate in this grant program.
So Mark, one quick thing, Mark. So the Blaine Amendments really were directed at Catholic schools.
Oh, yes.
It was the schools at that time.
Yes, so, quite explicit. Although, I mean, the Blaine Amendments, I believe, were written in terms of religious educational schools, but yes, everyone knows they were directed at Catholics for sure. Mm-hmm. So in this case, the Trinity Lutheran Church sued and said that refusing to allow them to participate in this program was a violation of the church's free exercise rights under the Constitution. And last month, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the church. The vote was 7-2, so it was pretty lopsided. But I think that the opinions in the case, even from those justices who supported the church, actually reveal more tension than that lopsided vote would suggest. So what the court held was, and the opinion is by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held that refusing to allow the church to participate in this grant program violated the Free Exercise Clause. Why? Because, the court said, Chief Justice Roberts said, that was conditioning the receipt of a government benefit on the religious identity of the recipient, the religious status of the recipient. Which, so in other words, the state of Missouri was targeting religion as such for less favored treatment. As a result, according to current constitutional law, the Missouri constitutional provision could stand only if the government had a compelling interest that it was promoting, and this was the most narrowly tailored way of reaching that interest. So the state of Missouri said, well, we have a compelling interest. The compelling interest is avoiding Establishment Clause problems. Because, mm-hmm. you know, if we're giving money to a church, that starts to look like an establishment of religion under current Supreme Court case law, Missouri said. And we want to avoid all of that. So our compelling interest in forbidding churches from participating in this program is to avoid an Establishment Clause problem. Chief Justice Roberts said, well, that's just not strong enough. This is, first of all, it's a very vague sort of thing. What Establishment Clause problems are you most concerned about? And anyway, to tell a church that it cannot participate on an equal basis with all other nonprofits in this public grant program is going too far. Even if you do have Establishment Clause concerns, that's going too far. So the court said, church wins.
Now that though sounds pretty strong, right? Where is the tension here that you mentioned a few minutes earlier?
Yes, good. Okay, so now the vote was 7-2 in favor of the church. Chief Justice Roberts got 6 votes for his opinion, so that is the majority opinion for the court. Justice Breyer concurred separately for other reasons. However, there is one footnote in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion that did not get 6 votes. In fact, Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Thomas, wrote a separate concurrence saying specifically they did not join footnote 3. It's always amusing for people who don't follow the court, the idea that you'd make an issue about footnote 3, and I'm not joining that. So footnote 3 is not part of the majority opinion. That's only for Chief Justice Roberts and 3 other justices. Justice Gorsuch concurred. He said, I agree the church wins, and I join most of the Chief Justice's opinion. But footnote 3, I cannot endorse. I'm not going to join that. Okay, so what does footnote 3 says? Footnote 3 was a sentence or two, which highlighted, Chief Justice Roberts highlighted in footnote 3, I'll quote it, this case involves, quote, discrimination based on religious identity with respect to playground resurfacing, not religious uses of funding or other forms of discrimination. Okay, this is only a case about discrimination based on religious identity and playground resurfacing. Okay. And Justice Gorsuch said, hold on, I'm not going along with that for a couple of reasons. One is that makes this seem almost trivial. This is just a case about playgrounds and scraped knees, and you know, that's not what the Supreme Court should be doing. We issue broad rulings that guide people, not this kind of thing, number one. More importantly, Justice Gorsuch said, I don't like this idea that we are characterizing the Free Exercise Clause as about protecting religious identity or religious status. What he said is, the Free Exercise Clause protects religious exercise, not status, not identity. It doesn't protect Lutherans as a group, the status of Lutherans as people. It protects people who exercise Lutheran beliefs. That's what it's about. So he said, to the extent that Chief Justice Roberts is saying this is all about status, that's what the Religion Clause is about, I don't agree with that.
I have to say, I hadn't thought about that, because I'd heard a little bit about this footnote. Can we drop the word identity, please, from all?
Well, it's not my word.
From all legal, from all legal things. But I think Gorsuch has the takes the case right there on that particular point. It is about exercise, not about Lutheran identity, for instance, and. One thing I would ask is, was that footnote a way for Justice Roberts to get Kagan on board?
That's what I would guess. I would guess that was a way to get Justice Kagan on board. Here's what I think is maybe going on here, and this is my interpretation of what's happening. I think Justice Gorsuch was concerned for the following reason. Because if we say that, well, religion is really a status, and the Free Exercise Clause protects that status, that identity, then you are perhaps opening the door for a future case in which government benefits could be denied on the basis of conduct. So here's what I'm thinking. Let's say we have a Lutheran church, a Lutheran school, Lutheran hospital of a conservative sort that at some point says, well, we're not going to give spousal benefits to same-sex married couples. And the local government where this church or hospital is located is upset about this, and they say, from now on, we're denying tax-exempt status to any organization that does not allow same-sex marital benefits. If the church then says, well, look, you're violating our religious freedom, well, you could look back to this case and say, religion is about status. Religious freedom is about status. We're not doing anything to you on the basis of your status because you are Lutherans. We are simply denying a benefit because of your conduct, because of what you're doing. And in Trinity Lutheran, we told you, religion is about status. Now, this may be a stretch, I understand, because in other contexts, the court has said there's not a status-conduct distinction. But I think, first of all, that may be the reason why Justice Gorsuch was, after all, it's just a footnote, saying I'm not joining this footnote. And it may also be why Justice Kagan signed on, because she may be seeing the same sort of thing.
What you're saying sounds logical.
That's how it seems to me. I mean, a lot of this, I'll concede, it's reading the tea leaves, but that's kind of what I think. It is, by the way, just to come back to your point from a minute ago, Mark, I think it is interesting just as a kind of cultural matter, sociological matter, because you're quite right, identity has taken over everything. That is the way in our culture we conceive of many of these disputes. And it's interesting to see maybe the Supreme Court, you know, I firmly believe that the law follows culture in the long run. And it's interesting to see how the court is now beginning to think of religion as a status to be negotiated like other statuses or identities in our society.
Yes, I had an email the other day. Someone objected to something I had written in somewhere else besides First Things, talking about how I was relying on my Catholic identity to say such and such. And I just wrote back and said, my Catholicism is not an identity. That's not something I say. This is who I am. My Catholicism goes deeper and wider.
It's very interesting.
Than that. It's not an identity. So now, all right. I think that clarifies nicely this Missouri case, and what you're saying, Mark, is that. The impact of this decision may not be as clear in the future as we would like to think.
Well, I think it's clear with respect to this, that after this case, a state cannot refuse to allow a church to participate in a public grant program because it is a church, because it has the name church on it or the name Lutheran on it. That's very clear. And there were, after all, 7 votes in favor of that proposition, although reasoned somewhat differently. However, it's hard to pin down the court in the religion cases. But to the extent the court is saying this is all about status and not about conduct, then that would suggest maybe troubling cases ahead. There was a dissent in the case, by the way, I should say. Justice Sotomayor dissented, actually read her dissent from the bench, which is seen as a major signal of disagreement. And her point was that, look, Missouri was right. These really were serious Establishment Clause problems. And we have a tradition in America of not allowing state money to go to churches. And I'll just quote what she says. Today's decision discounts centuries of history and jeopardizes the government's ability to remain secular. That itself is somewhat interesting, since whether the Establishment Clause requires a secular government is itself very much contested.
Centuries! You know, I did a book, you know, about a race riot that took place in Atlanta 110 years ago. At the center of that was a political campaign. All you have to do is read the speeches, go through the newspapers, and religion was everywhere in political life. Ministers were called upon to opine about what was happening during the campaign. They would testify before the Atlanta City Council and in the legislature. The idea that we've had a secular government for centuries is simply historically wrong. Where were her clerks curbing her on that historical error? Wow. It says a lot about legal education in America today. Okay, Mark, let's move to the... Maybe we'll spend a few minutes on the Trump travel ban. And in that decision, what was the stake that came before the court?
So there actually are a couple of these travel ban cases which have been consolidated. One of them is from the Ninth Circuit out on the West Coast, and one of them is from the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, two lower courts in the federal system. These involve an executive order issued by President Trump which suspends immigration from six Muslim-majority countries, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, for 90 days. And the stated rationale for this executive order is national security. The argument is that these countries pose a heightened risk of terrorism, and so therefore we're going to be suspending immigration for 90 days from these countries to try to figure it out. I should say, by the way, the designation as the heightened risk here, that designation comes from the Obama administration. It didn't come from the Trump administration itself.
For those six countries?
For those six countries, correct. Mm-hmm. So the plaintiffs challenged the executive order, among other reasons, as a violation of the Establishment Clause. And their argument was this executive order, notwithstanding what it says, is not about national security. Rather, it's motivated by animus towards Muslims, which they argue makes it a violation of the Establishment Clause. The lower courts agreed and issued preliminary injunctions barring the government from enforcing the executive order. And when they did that, the government appealed to the Supreme Court and asked for a writ of certiorari, which means they asked the court to hear the case, to decide the case. Last month, the court granted that, granted the writ, so the court will hear the case. It's going to hear it in October. And also, the court, for the time being, stayed the injunctions pending review. So let me just explain what that means. The lower courts issued injunctions against enforcement. The Supreme Court now stayed the injunction, which means the order can now be enforced. So the order is now enforceable, except with regard to foreign nationals who have, I'm quoting now from the Supreme Court's decision, have a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the U.S., a bona fide relationship with a person or entity. And that is currently being litigated, exactly what that means. Does it mean grandparents? Is that a close enough relative? Does it mean cousins?
Does the Trump administration give any advice on that?
They have. They've issued an order which excluded grandparents. That's one of the things that's being litigated in the lower courts.
Oh, immediate family.
Immediate family. So it's certainly...
Parents and children.
Parents and
siblings.
Children. Siblings. I think siblings. I'm not sure about siblings.
Okay.
If you're a student and you have been admitted to a university in the United States, that counts. You can come in. However, with the exception of that group of people, the Supreme Court stayed the injunction, which means pending review, the order can be enforced. And there's something else too, which is to prevail on a claim that the injunction should be stayed. The government had to show, this is the rule, the government had to show that it had a strong likelihood of success on the merits. That's the standard for granting a stay of an injunction in the Supreme Court, that the claimant has shown a likelihood of success on the merits, a strong likelihood. So the implication is, by granting the stay, the court has signaled that ultimately, in October, when it hears the case, the government has a strong likelihood of success on the merits. It looks like this order is going to be enforced. In fact, three of the justices, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Alito, separately wrote they would have stayed the entire injunction. They wouldn't have allowed this exception for foreign nationals with a bona fide relationship with the U.S. So, So it looks pretty good for the Trump administration. Ultimately, when the court hears this case in October, it looks like the Trump administration will prevail. Now, there are a lot of issues in the case. There are procedural issues. There are national security issues. So this could go on a number of different ways. There's also an Establishment Clause issue, too.
Is there... an issue with localities simply saying, whatever, we're going to continue doing, even if that means lack of cooperation with the federal government, we're going to continue doing what we're doing?
Yeah, well, look, it's a different question if that comes up. I mean, in our system, the federal government has plenary authority over immigration. And actually, there are cases that say when the president makes a decision like this about excluding immigrants on the basis of a national security concern, the courts are not supposed to investigate that. If it's you know, on its face, a legitimate reason, there's a national security concern, courts traditionally are very reluctant to question the president's judgment about that. So this was really quite astounding that these lower courts, the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit, really went out of their way to say, well, we are not going to defer to this. This is obviously whatever the Trump administration is saying, this is obviously not what they were about. That's quite unusual. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think it would also be unusual for localities simply to say, we're not going to abide by this. But look, it could happen, sure.
I saw some reports critiquing these injunctions on the grounds that the judges were deriving their opinions from inferences about the president's motives, mm-hmm. almost personal motives, things he said during the campaign. Were those, if that was the case, are those kinds of inferences out of bounds?
Well, that's one of the things that would be litigated. I think so personally myself. So this is the Establishment Clause claim. Under some current Supreme Court precedents, there's an Establishment Clause violation if the government takes action that sends a message of disparagement towards a religious group. Mm-hmm. If it seems like the government is motivated by animus towards that group. These are cases involving public religious displays. You know, like a Christmas tree on public property. If the court looks at it and says, well, a reasonable person would see placing the Christmas tree here is endorsing one religion or disparaging a different religion, then it's unconstitutional. So the courts, these lower courts, said, well, we apply that reasoning here, and we think that the reasonable person would see this travel ban as disparaging Muslims. Why? Well, because look at everything that President Trump said during the campaign. He had all this stuff about a Muslim ban and, you know, very, very unfortunate, very disparaging things that he said. It really is a stretch to interpret a government action on the basis of campaign statements. You know, normally speaking, we interpret a law, an executive order, a statute. We interpret it according to its text, or some people would be a little more liberal. They would say, well, we interpret it according to its text and also the history of its enactment, but the official history of its enactment. Mm-hmm. What did people say on the record in Congress? What did the president say on the record when he issued it? I don't know of cases that say, well, to understand the law, we go back and see what the senator said on the campaign trail that he mm-hmm. was going to do, mm-hmm. for pretty obvious reasons, because everybody knows campaign statements are really not worth very much. I mean, nobody thinks that, you know, you're going to be held, for better or worse, nobody thinks you're going to be held to exactly what you say on the campaign trail when you look at the law later. So to my mind, that really was a stretch. Also, as far as I know, the court has never applied the Establishment Clause to questions about national security and foreign nationals. That also is a stretch. So, but look, you had the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit both say there were Establishment Clause problems here. It doesn't look like that's going to win at the Supreme Court, though.
All right. Very good. Let's go to the Colorado Baker case. What is the background here?
Okay, so this has been a much-watched case. It's one of several same-sex marriage cases, or I should say, commercial service that same-sex marriage cases that have been percolating in the lower courts for a while. In this particular case, a Colorado cake shop declined to design and bake a cake for a same-sex wedding ceremony. And the shop owner said he declined because his religious convictions against same-sex marriage made it impossible for him to participate. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission ruled that he had violated the state's public accommodation law, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. He appealed to the state courts. The Colorado state courts ruled against him. So then he has now sought review in the Supreme Court, and in June the court granted the case. So what he's arguing is this. He's making the argument that compelling him to design the cake and bake the cake for this couple would violate his free speech rights, because that would compel him to endorse conduct he disapproves, to express his agreement or his endorsement of conduct that he disapproves, and also would violate his free exercise rights, because it would compel him to engage in conduct that goes against his religious convictions. So those are the issues here. Of course, we haven't seen the merits briefs yet, but it does seem we can sort of tell what the arguments are going to be.
Let me ask you this. The news stories on this said the Colorado baker refused to serve gays. Now, first, he had been serving everyone. He didn't ask them, I mean, in the past. Now,
I think he had been serving this couple. He'd certainly been serving one of them, was a client, was a customer.
Okay. Now, would he have made a wedding cake for them that was just plain generic, that had no message or indication that it was for a same-sex wedding? Do we know that?
No, this is an excellent point, Mark. And as a court watcher, I'm a little bit surprised the court took this case, because there is a factual problem with this case. We don't know what they wanted him to write on the cake, because
exactly.
He just said, no, I'm not doing it for you. So if his claim is, you are requiring me to say something I don't believe, well, we don't know on the facts exactly what they wanted him to say. So that might make it complicated in this case, trying to figure out exactly who should prevail. On the other hand, I assume the court would not have granted cert if they didn't think they could get past that factual complication.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see what they say. But you're right. In this case,
one can see it would be quite different if they asked him to put two men on top of the cake holding hands. If there were a message, you know, Steve and Adam, right, on top of the cake. But if it had no message, I think that could be a much different situation.
Yeah, well, that would suggest they shouldn't have taken this case, because the case will not be a vehicle for resolving this dispute. If we don't know what they wanted him to say, how can we resolve this case? That's what I think. Look, as a former Supreme Court clerk looking at this, the first thing jumped out at me was, well, isn't this a factual problem? Is this the best vehicle for resolving this dispute? But I guess they thought it was. And of course, I think we can presume that the couple wanted a happy saying. We can presume they didn't just want a blank cake. But look, I agree, this is a problem, potentially.
It's interesting that I haven't seen any clarification of any of that in the stories. Now, one thing that I noted was the actions of the state against the Colorado baker sound like a very heavy hand. Diversity training, they want, I believe, quarterly reports on how this bakery is adjusting itself to get past its discriminatory assumptions. I don't remember if there was a stiff fine or not. Certainly there were other bakeries nearby that the couple could have gone to as well. We'll see. But the fact that they took that case, because in the past, hasn't the Supreme Court declined a couple of similar
yes.
cases? There was the New Mexico
New Mexico case, yes, that's right. There's a case out of Washington State, which I believe they're currently, it's currently under review. I'm sorry, there's a cert petition. I think it either has already been filed or it's about to be filed.
Would the court try to bundle those cases together, or?
Could be. I don't think so. I mean, conceivably they could. They certainly could. Yes, they could put them together, I guess, if they think they're presenting all the same issues. Normally what they would do, though, is they would decide one of them and they would hold the other's pending decision of the case, and then they would remand saying, you know, for proceedings consistent with our opinion.
You know, someone said to me a while back when the court declined the New Mexico photographer case that this wasn't necessarily a permanent posture on the part of the court, but the court was waiting to see how this issue of commercial activities surrounding same-sex marriage was going to evolve, and that they would end up taking a case that would provide clarification for all the other cases that might come forward, which suggests to me that this Colorado Baker case it probably does have something more complicated than just a generic cake that doesn't look any different for this same-sex wedding as one would look for a traditional wedding.
Well, we have to assume that, as I say, otherwise the court wouldn't have taken the case. They would have held it, or they would have waited for another one of these cases. The commercial context, I think, is, you know, genuinely makes it complicated. So his claim is, again, if we put aside the factual problem that we don't know exactly what they wanted him to say, his point is, look, I have a free speech right not to say something that I don't believe. And there are certainly cases that hold that the government cannot compel someone to say something he doesn't agree with, and they can't compel him to carry a message for someone else if he doesn't want to. The question in the case is going to be whether designing and baking a cake as part of your commercial activity really is an expressive activity. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, do people understand the inscription on a wedding cake as a reflection of the baker's genuine sentiments about things? I mean, you know, you just make a wedding cake, you put anything on the couple wants, doesn't mean you necessarily approve of the wedding or like the couple or anything else.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's what he's going to have to get past. Now, I think he certainly has good claim. I don't want the listeners to think that I'm dismissing it. I think it is a good claim, but I think there's a problem with the fact that, you know, most of us understand the baker doesn't necessarily endorse this at all. He's just getting paid for a service.
Well, it could come down to how seriously judges and others take religious convictions.
Mm-hmm. Ah, that's a different issue, actually.
What's the big deal? I mean, just, you got a client. The client wants to do the customer. Give the customer what the customer wants. You're just a service provider. And one that says, you know, religious convictions are sort of like political convictions. You know, you can suspend those in order to do work for a political campaign in which you don't necessarily like that politician. But religious, it almost depends on whether people regard a religious conviction as belonging in a separate category.
Yeah, this is an interesting point. So he, in addition to his free speech claim, he also raises a free exercise claim. He says that requiring him to design and bake this cake is requiring him to engage in conduct that goes against his religious conviction. So essentially he's saying, I would like a religious exemption from the anti-discrimination laws. Now, about 25 years ago, a little more than 25 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled in a case called Employment Division versus Smith that, generally speaking, there is no right to a religious accommodation. If a state has a law that is generally applicable and neutral with respect to religion, then there is really not a right to a constitutional exemption. There's not a constitutional right to a religious exemption. Just P.S., Trinity Lutheran was different, because Trinity Lutheran involved a law that specifically targeted religion for less favorable treatment. Okay, but this doesn't. The Colorado law doesn't target religion. It says everybody has to do this. So really, if you just stop there, it doesn't look so good for the baker on the religious exercise claim from the federal constitutional perspective. However, in Employment Division versus Smith, there is a paragraph in which the court says, if there's a hybrid claim that involves both religious freedom and some other constitutional right, then the compelling interest test is triggered. Then the government has to make a showing for why it should not accommodate this person. And here, I think what the baker will argue is this is one of those so-called hybrid cases, because he is making both a free exercise claim and a free speech claim. Now, scholars look at this language in Smith about the hybrid case, and we scratch our heads. We don't really know what that's all about. This will be an opportunity for the court to explain what that's all about, but that's, I think, a lurking issue in the case, too.
Mark, thank you very much, and I think we're going to have you back for our next Supreme Court examination.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.